A reading from Samuel. And the Lord sent Nathan to David. He came to him and said to him, "There were two men in a certain city, the one rich and the other poor. The rich man had very many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing but one little ewe lamb, which he had bought. He brought it up, and it grew up with him and with his children. It used to eat of his meager fare and drink from his cup and lie in his bosom, and it was like a daughter to him. Now there came a traveler to the rich man, and he was loath to take one of his own flock of herd to prepare for the wayfarer who had come to him. But he took the poor man's lamb and prepared that for the guest who had come to him. Then David's anger was greatly kindled against the man. He said to Nathan, "As the Lord lives, the man who has done this deserves to die. He shall restore the lamb fourfold because he did this thing and because he had no pity." Nathan said to David, "You are the man." The word of God for the people of God.
Today we start a new series called The Friendship Formula, and we're going to be thinking about the place of friendships in our lives. And to do so, I want you to think about the people who have had that special place in your life, the best of friends. When I think about this, I think about my very first best friend, Jeff. We met in the fifth grade, and we quickly bonded. By the sixth grade, we were wearing matching clothes. We had these jean jackets, and we put this big furry foot on the back that was orange because we loved the skateboard. It was a hang 10 symbol. He invited me to learn the game of tennis. He taught me how to snow ski. He was very musically inclined and talented, so he played the drums. I played the guitar, and we invited a couple of other people, and we formed the band Pegasus. Three talented people plus me. And as I think about friendships, particularly the best of friends, I think about the people that invite us to see the world differently, to live in this world differently, to live in this world more fully. That's what Jeff, as my best friend then, did for me. Now, when we think about friendships, we know they're special, we can kind of feel it, but we don't always consider what are the ingredients that make the relationship so special? What should be the ingredients that can make a relationship special? That's why we're going to slow down for just a couple of weeks and consider what is it that we need in relationships that can help us live more fully in this world. I want to introduce this concept called holy friendship. I came across it about 4 years ago, and it's this. It says, "Holy friends challenge the sins we've come to love, affirm the gifts we're afraid to claim, and help us to dream dreams we otherwise would not dream." That's holy friendship, and that's what we're going to be looking at. Now, to do so, we have to talk about two very churchy words, holy and sin. Honestly, I thought about changing them. Even though I didn't invent the concept holy friendship, I thought, well, let's just soften it up a bit. You know, we don't like to use the word holy, holier than thou, but really, holy means set apart, special, sacred. That's easy to understand. It just means it's those friendships that are, we know they hold a special and almost sacred character in our lives. But then we have to address the word sin. Who likes to talk about sin except many preachers, I guess, but I don't. Because of all the negative baggage. And so I almost jettisoned it, but then I realized if we don't talk about it, we're going to be missing something. Something important about what this means to challenge the sins we've come to love. Now, one of the reasons that sin gets such a bad rap, so to speak, and carries so much negative baggage is the way that it's been interpreted and understood in history. There was a strain of Christianity, and there still is, that interprets sin in a legal mode. It means that you need to have rules, laws, commandments, and when you violate one of those, you need to be judged and punished to set things right. That's the way the world works. That's the way God works. And notice in that image that you need someone who's ready to punish. And that person, that being, was claimed to be God. And so the church, in living this out, took some extreme measures. They took sin very seriously. And if you were found to have broken one of those rules, commands, laws, you were punished. How were you punished? You were told that you could no longer come into the church sanctuary. You were asked to kneel outside before the services in sackcloth and ashes, which is a kind of a black, coarse garment with ash on your face to show that you were penitent, that you wanted to change your ways. And so as you would come to worship, you'd pass, "Hey, Judy, Bill, wonder what they did this week," because they're sitting outside kneeling. Now, if it was a minor thing, in a matter of weeks or months, you could work your way back into church. If it was a grave sin, you might spend years on your knees in sackcloth waiting for permission to get back in. That was your punishment. But it was also made public because your sin wasn't just against God, it was against the church. So even if you confessed your sin privately, they would announce it publicly so everybody knew what you did. Can you imagine that? Who would even want to come? I remember I was at a conference, a Christian conference, and there was a pastor kind of giving a talk, and he got on the topic of sin. And so he stopped and said, "I want everybody to stand up," and we all stood up. He said, "Now I want you to think about the three worst sins in your life." So we thought about the three worst sins. He said, "Now I want you to turn and share those three sins with the person next to you." People were actually doing it. I turned to the person next to me, whom I did not know, and I said, "You know there's no way this is going to happen, right?" No way. So we just stood there awkwardly where everybody talked about their sins. Now, the sad thing is the church can still be like this. We know this. There are still people who are not out on their knees, but they're tossed out. They're not allowed in. They're not welcomed and loved and included because they don't live up to the rules, laws, and commandments that the church has set that you need to abide by to be a part of this place. They're still excluded. Maybe that's why we don't like talking about sin. But that's not really what sin is about. Let's just take a minute to reframe what it is, because then we'll better understand what it means to challenge the sins we've come to love. If we go back to Judaism, sin literally means, in Hebrew, missing the mark. Missing the mark, that God created us to live in a certain way, to be in a certain way. And when we refuse to be in that way, we miss the mark in life. We'll never flourish. And Jesus, building upon that, talked about sin not as something that you watch and catch people doing on the exterior in our actions, but as something that develops on the inside, in the heart and mind. And he would liken it to a tree that bears fruit. That if a tree has the nourishment and nurture that it needs, it bears these fruits that offer good things to the people around it. But if a tree doesn't have that nourishment and that nurture, then it won't bear fruit. And so the solution with sin is not punishment. It's providing the nurturing and the nourishment and the healing so that the tree can bear fruit again, so that we can bear fruit again in our lives. That's sin. And building on that, other theologians have picked up on those themes because they're so important. Hildegard of Bingen, a 12th century really thinker and leader, she was brilliant. Here's how she described sin. She said, "Sin is when we become careless with our lives." That's provocative to me. Sin is when we become careless with our lives. She said it's when we begin to lose our usefulness and we lose our passion for living. That's what sin is. Richard Rohr, who writes about spirituality and theology today, says that sin happens when we refuse to keep growing. When we refuse to keep growing. Now think about this. If we weren't growing anymore, and if we were careless with our lives, if we're losing our usefulness, wouldn't we want somebody to tell us? Wouldn't we want to know so that we could change the direction of our lives? That's what challenging the sins we've come to love is all about. But it's not easy. The question becomes, who do we allow in our lives that we give the power, the ability to challenge us? We don't like to be challenged, particularly around things we love. That's why this morning's text for me is so powerful. Here's the background. briefly, all very briefly. King David had an affair with Bathsheba. Well, her husband Uriah was off in battle. He was one of his closest allies as a soldier. And he was trying to cover it up, and he went through all kinds of means to try to cover up this affair. And finally, he could not cover it up, so he sent Uriah to the front line so he would be killed. Problem done. It's a horrible story. But he doesn't see what he's doing. And so Nathan, the prophet, comes and tells him that something's wrong in the kingdom, that there's a rich man who has many sheep, and then there's a poor man who has just one lamb, one sheep. And he loves this sheep. And the rich man has so many, he can't even count them. Well, a guest comes into town for the rich man, and he wants to show hospitality by slaughtering a sheep to offer. Does he take one of his own? No. He takes the only sheep of the poor man. And when David hears this, David's furious, and he wants to know who this man is. And Nathan says to him in those powerful words, "You are the man." Now, what's interesting to me is David is a king. David could have shut Nathan down. David could have said off with his head. But there was something about their relationship that Nathan could speak those words to him and he could hear them. Who do we have in our lives that we listen to, that special relationship that at times can challenge us? And it's not easy because we're talking about the sins that we love. That is, those things that we do that don't draw us closer together in relationships, but make us more distant. Those things that aren't life-giving for us and others, but the things that actually diminish the quality of our lives. When we have that happening in our lives, and yet we love what we're doing, who can challenge us? Now, what would be a sin that we might love? I'll tell you one of mine. Here we go. I wouldn't tell somebody the three before, but I'm going to tell you one. One sin I love. Working too much. I love what I do. And there's been periods in my life that I worked way, way too much. When I first started in ministry, I worked 80 plus hours a week. Way too much. I had a young family. There were days and weeks where I would get up before my kids got up, come home after they were in bed, and I never, ever saw them. Now, I was doing, I thought, for a good purpose. I really loved my life and what I was doing. But then I had a holy friend challenge me. My spouse, Tina. Now, I won't tell you what she said, but she did challenge me with something that I loved. And it made me realize in that moment, that aha, that this was not bringing us closer together at all. It was distancing us. This wasn't breathing life into my family or me. It was doing quite the opposite. And if she hadn't challenged me in that way, I wouldn't have changed how I lived and my priorities. And I thank God that she did that for me. So who do you have in your life that can challenge the sins that you love? The things that you do that create distance in your relationship? The things that you do that do not breathe life into you? That diminish your life and the life of others? Who can do that? Now, I know many of you want to volunteer to be the one who challenges sin in other people's life. It's like your spiritual gift. That's not what this is about. It's not about being able to challenge someone. It's about developing that close and connected relationship, that special, holy, and sacred relationship in which you can be heard and someone can listen so that things can actually change. And someone who's willing to challenge you just isn't there to challenge you. A holy friend is there with you to help you pick up the pieces afterwards, to walk with you, to get to that new place, to the place where you live more fully in this world and you flourish. A friend will be there to walk with you. I'm mindful when I say this of the Special Olympics. They were running the 100-meter dash. Of course, they took off and they're going for the gold, but one of them stumbled and fell, and he started to cry. Now, the ones at the front, they kept running as fast as they could, but those that were behind could see that he had stumbled, so they walked over to him, and one of them leans down, kisses him on the head, and said, "That will make it better." And then they held hands and they walked to the finish line together. That's holy friends. Someone, when we stumble and fall, that is there to hug us, to kiss us, to lift us up and walk with us so so that we can live in a better way, in a bolder way, in a way in which we can flourish. Holy friends challenge the sins we've come to love, and thank God that they do. And as we talk about this, it's so appropriate that we're doing it on Pentecost. Now, the connection might not seem obvious, but when we think about what Pentecost means, this moment, it's the moment when the Spirit came to the disciples. And what did it do? It drew them closer together. And if we read about it in Acts 2, it says this, that when that Spirit came and filled them and drew them closer together, they began to prophesy, which doesn't mean foretelling, it means truth-telling. And it said they began to dream dreams. And then we learn later that it helped bring out the gifts that God had given each person that they could offer to those around them so that we all might live better lives. Pentecost really is celebrating holy friendship in a sense, the kind of friends that challenge the sins we've come to love, affirm the gifts we're afraid to claim, and help us to dream dreams we otherwise would not dream. May the Spirit today draw us closer together and help us to be holy friends to one another. Amen.